Is the American dream dead? On the evening of September 28, 2022, at the Ellen Theater, Bozeman Public Library's award-winning community forum, Symbosium, convened a panel moderated by Dr. Jelani Mahiri and featuring Dr. Shane Doyle, Ariana Flores, and Dr. Matthew Steger to explore that question. To begin the discussion, Christy Smith, a.k.a. Christy the Wordsmith, introduced the history of the phrase, the American dream.
I believe that when we deal with abstractions, especially one as complex as our topic at hand this evening, it's really helpful to seek out some concrete information about the related terminology. That's my specialty and my contribution, a grounding baseline for tonight's discussion. The expression, the American dream, is so familiar to us that it seems as though it's always been there, hardwired into the language. But it's a kind of a free-form linguistic icon. It invites us to play around with its image because it can mean almost anything we want it to mean at any given time. Over the decades, the American dream has been associated with a handful of ideals we hold dear: equal opportunity, success, home ownership, self-determination. 12 men and women on the street will define the American dream a dozen different ways. I consulted 3 dictionaries and found as many definitions. But this elusive expression didn't just magically appear, of course. Like every single word and phrase in our vocabulary, this one has its own biography. One man is credited for its popularity: American writer and historian James Truslow Adams, born in Brooklyn, New York, in 1878. In the midst of our country's Great Depression, he published a narrative history of the United States called The Epic of America. In this 1931 publication, Adams reviewed how the average American had matured over time in outlook, character, and opinion. He placed his observations before the backdrop of what he called the American dream, which he defined as not a dream of motor cars and high wages merely, but a dream of a social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain to the fullest stature of which they are innately capable and be recognized for what they are, regardless of the circumstances of birth or position. James Truslow Adams alluded to this dream in 50 passages of his 1931 book, The Epic of America. From there, the expression grew some powerful legs, galloping through countless publications and a century of political and cultural discourse. But the term has changed over time. Each generation since Adams and his Epic of America has seen the expression through the lens of its own concern. How will we see it tonight? Let's discuss.
From my left to my right, we have Dr. Shane Doyle. We have Ariana Flores, and we have Dr. Matthew Steger. Dr. Matthew Steger is a research scientist at Opportunity Insights, a social science research lab based at Harvard University. There he uses big data to identify policies that promote upward mobility, including neighborhood housing policies. He also studies how people find jobs. Matthew holds a PhD in economics from the University of Maryland, and he lives in the Boston area.
All right, hello. Thanks so much for the introduction, and thank you to the Bozeman Public Library for putting on this event and inviting me out here. As Jelani mentioned, I am a research scientist at Opportunity Insights, and most of the researchers at Opportunity Insights are economists, as am I by training. And as Jelani mentioned, what we do is we use big data. So these are things like administrative data from tax returns or more recently data from Facebook. And we use these data to understand the determinants of economic and social mobility in the United States. And so one kind of striking pattern that we've found in the data is that the American dream appears to be a fading reality for younger generations of Americans. So what do I mean by that? There's many ways that you could think of defining the American dream, and I think we'll kind of get into some of those definitions later tonight. But one definition that you can at least measure in the data is to ask whether one generation is going on and earning more than their parents. So this is kind of a direct measure of economic progress from one generation to the next. And so if you were to go look in the data, you would find that 90% of people who were born in 1940 went on to earn more than their parents, but that over time, the probability that people went on to earn more than their parents declined steadily, so that by the time you get to 1980, only 50% of people born in 1980 went on to earn more than their parents. And so in other words, this version of the American dream was a near certainty for people who were born in 1940, and it declined to a mere coin flip for people born in 1980. And so, you know, I think this kind of like stark decline in mobility raises a number of key questions. So first, does our country actually provide economic opportunity to all Americans? And second, if not, what can we do about it? And so, you know, I think regardless of where you fall on the political spectrum, the idea that our country should kind of provide opportunity to all people is something that we can all agree on. So I think the kind of motivation behind all of the work that I do and all the work that Opportunity Insights does is not to lobby for some kind of specific set of policies, but rather to try to put together kind of the best objective facts available so that we can understand what the drivers of mobility are and identify the policies, programs, and interventions that are going to be most effective at kind of promoting economic mobility. So looking forward to kind of discussing issues related to the American dream with you all and sharing my perspective based on the research we have in economics. Thanks.
Next up, we have Ariana Flores, who works with the Equity Project, a leading equity, diversity, and inclusion consulting firm. Originally from Texas, the proud Chicana feminist has been an attorney, advocate, and community organizer on issues including wage theft, immigrants' rights, employment discrimination, healthcare access, and LGBTQIA plus rights. Ariana completed her JD at the University of Washington Law School. Ariana Flores, thank you.
Thanks, Jelani. Hello, everyone. Thank you all for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here this evening with you all. When I heard the topic that we'd be discussing tonight, I got really excited about the possibility of diving into this mythology around the American dream and to really grapple with the various questions that it raises for us as individuals, but also for us as a society. I grew up in Corpus Christi, Texas, and grew up in a poor family. We were on government assistance at various points and struggled to make ends meet on a regular basis. And I remember as I was growing up and sort of became an adolescent and an annoying teenager, and I would express resentment about the various wants that my parents couldn't deliver and sometimes the needs that they couldn't deliver for me, my mom's response was always, work hard, focus on your education so that you can make it, so that you can get to a place where when you have a family, when you're an adult, you won't have to struggle like this. And that was really ingrained in me, and I did what I was told. I did all the things that you're supposed to do. Worked hard. I went to school. I studied. I got the scholarships. And I was able to, in a lot of ways, attain what a lot of people think of when they think of the American dream. And when I heard this topic, while on the one hand, I am sort of a living embodiment of the proof that it exists and that it's still attainable, I've really been grappling with all of the people along my path that, in spite of also being intelligent and talented and having a drive, haven't attained that dream. And so one of the things that I hope we'll get to tonight is to really think about the ways in which the individuality within that mythology ends up being the examples that we point to rather than the multitude, I would argue, of people that haven't quite been able to attain that dream. And this conversation could go in so many directions, and so we'll follow the audience's lead as to, you know, which directions we go, but I am excited to deal with the complexity and the nuance that this topic requires along with you all, and so thank you.
And last but not least, of course, Dr. Shane Doyle. Shane Doyle, Upsaloga. I worked hard and I'm still working on it. Upsaloga is a scholar, cultural and educational consultant, and community advocate whose work focuses on the indigenous people of the northern Great Plains. He holds a PhD in curriculum and instruction from MSU, Montana State University here in Bozeman, and completed postdoctoral research in genetics with the University of Copenhagen. An artist and Plains Indian style singer, Shane lives here in Bozeman with his wife and five children. Dr. Shane Doyle.
Thank you to the library for hosting this great event, and so thankful and honored to be a part of this conversation here with these distinguished scholars, and thanks for coming out, everybody. So I'm a local. You know, I grew up on the Crow Indian Reservation, and I think my conduit to the American dream was television, just like everybody else. And so that's where I learned about the American dream. And one thing I learned was it didn't pertain to me. That was for everybody else out there in America, all the white people and ostensibly black people, and, you know, like Michael Jackson and, you know, those other ones that are so successful, right? And any number of immigrants who come here that excel in math and science and art and everything else. But for Indian kids, we were not really part of that. And I always felt like living on a reservation was like living behind a two-way mirror. You know, I could see everyone else out there on TV and the books and the newspapers and the magazines and radio, but no one was looking back at me. No one was looking back at my community. I didn't see my community in any television or movies or in anything accurate, of course, anywhere else. And so I think I grew up not picturing myself in that American dream, but I still had the sense of a dreamer because, of course, this land here in Montana is the home of dreamers. There is no other place in the world where people take dreams as seriously as this place here where we're at. You know, I mean, we can go a very long ways back. There is nothing that surpasses a dream on this land here, going thousands of years back. And so it's very apropos. And then thinking about Bozeman and how Bozeman embodies the American dream and has embodied the American dream successively in 150-year spans. So first we had the first gold rush here where people were coming for that freedom and that opportunity and that shot at equality and comfort and all those things that money can provide. And then the gold ran out and, you know, we turned to cows and wheat and all this. And then there was a gold rush that started happening here right around 25, 30 years ago, and it's only intensified and now it's at a fever pitch. Except now the people are bringing the gold. And they're bringing it because there's something here that's more important and better than anything gold has to offer. Clean air and clean water, good schools, good amenities, safety. But it comes at a very, very steep price, and the price keeps getting higher. And the higher that price goes, the higher that dream goes up into the sky. And so it's like an eagle carrying those high winds, those hot air into the sky. Pretty soon we can't see it anymore. And so those are just a few metaphors that come to mind. And, you know, I'm just, again, thankful and looking forward to hearing from my colleagues about how this whole discussion can progress. Thank you.
Thank you all. I have a couple questions just to get us started, and we've kind of touched around the topic a bit, and we heard Christy, the wordsmith, who I was a DJ for a while at KJLT, so to actually meet her in person, I'm a little bit starstruck. I'm sure she'll do an etymology of starstruck next time. She mentioned James T. Adams and the kind of origins, if you will, of the American dream, and that's one definition. She also mentioned how it's changed over time, depending on generations. And I'm just wondering if you all be open to starting. You've touched a little bit, but You've mentioned how your company approaches it and some ideas, but what does the American dream mean to you all?
For me, the American dream is some vague sense of whether or not everyone in the country has the opportunity to kind of reach their potential and achieve their dreams. But I don't have kind of the luxury of working with kind of vague concepts. And in my day-to-day, I'm working with kind of hard data. And what we're able to measure for, you know, large portions of the population is income. And so the aspect of the American dream that I focus on in my research is about income and economic mobility. And so I think this is only part of the American dream, but I do think kind of a key part of the American dream is providing economic opportunity for people, both because achieving economic success, I think, is important in its own right, but we also know that's kind of associated with a lot of other things in life. So things like health and other things like that. So yeah, I think most of what I'll have to say is kind of about economic opportunity. For me, that's just kind of part, one important part of the American dream.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that for me, the idea or the concept of the American dream has largely been rooted in that economic prosperity piece, homeownership, or being able to get out of debt. That, I think, for my generation, for my friend groups, has been a real motivating factor of, can I just not have this crippling debt every month so that it can free me up to do the things that I want to do? And one thing that I thought was really interesting in the survey that we took that I hope a lot of you participated in, that in addition to the economic piece, there were also points that people resonated with around things like safety and being able to pursue your own goals. And it really helped me to think about it in a different way, because the way that it was ingrained in me was very economic, probably because we didn't, that was the thing that we were lacking. And I think when you don't have access to something, it makes it something that you want even more. And so I think thinking through the ways in which our own individual experiences shapes, you know, what is the thing that we want most, sort of the grass is greener piece, and being able to pursue various ideas or a career or hobbies even that maybe don't feel as accessible can, for a lot of people, be their American dream. And so I liked the conception of it sort of changing over time and morphing into whatever it is that a person decides it to be.
I agree with you very much. And as far as like myself and my generation, me and my sister, I think, have achieved very high education. And growing up, that was always, that was foremost that my mother emphasized for her and I. And then in my community, there was an emphasis on education. That was really, that was where it's at. Because, you know, you can develop a lot of things in this life, but folks agreed that it was so important to develop your mind, to learn, to be able to understand this world that we're living in and how you can fit in and make a career, make a life for yourself. And I think to me, the American dream was like, you know, hooking on to some corporate or public or some other institution. And so that was the idea of getting education, was then you got picked up by the man, MSU, or Hardin Public Schools, or Indian Health Service, or Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so my whole life growing up, I thought, well, I wonder which one of these big ships I'm going to be hooking on to. And I figured, you know, it's course of my life, I'll probably just go from ship to ship. And then at one point, I found myself like out in the middle of the ocean, like on a life raft. And all the ships that were going were like way over there. And it seemed to me like the American dream was like drifting away, evaporating in front of my eyes, even with all the education, all the experience, all the skills, all the talent, all the desire, all the work. I just couldn't, honestly, could not find a way to hook on to those big ships. And then just started figuring, well, I guess I'm going to have to build my own ship. And years have gone by. It's been 6 years now since I've had to separate myself from my lifelong idea of what the American dream was. and have now developed a career that I never ever would have dreamed or foreseen, but I feel very fulfilled by. And in a lot of ways it is, I am living the American dream because I do get to choose who I work with for the most part. I do get to choose my hours. I am doing stuff that I'm passionate about. I'm doing stuff that I'm good at. And I'm getting better. And it feels good. And I'm starting to get respect and the money that comes along with it. So on one hand, I could sit back and say, oh, it's great. You know, it worked out. But I can tell you that it wasn't the plan. And I don't think anyone would have said, Shane, if you do this, you know, in 6 years, you'll be great. Everyone would have been saying, did you apply for... How did the job come out? You know, did you get interviewed for the such and such? Or, oh, I'm sorry, you know, he didn't get, you know, oh, well, you know, maybe next time, you know. And then people will be like, oh, you know, you could get on over at da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, now I'm at the point where it's like, I don't want no full-time job. I got a full-time job offered to me, honestly, this past month. It wasn't a guarantee. It was something that I could have applied for, and it could have paid me a lot of money. But even at that, I didn't want it. Because that wasn't the dream for me anymore. My dream has changed now. You know, my dream is not to, you know, hook onto the biggest ship and then just kick back and, you know, eat peanuts and throw my shells on the ship's deck. I mean, I want to be steering this ship. You know, I want to make sure that we land in the places where we need to go and that the people, you know, on board are happy with their voyage. So, I don't know, and I want to go off too far onto... to the deep blue sea. But another metaphor for you, and I think my mom probably doesn't know what to think about my career, but I know she's happy, and so I'm thankful.
One thing you said, Shane, made me think of how our initial circumstances really shape even what we see as possibilities. That, you know, you're talking about the institutions that you were exposed to, and those are the ones that you said, okay, I can hook myself onto those, right? And what happens if you aren't exposed to as many things? I did a speaking engagement recently where I was reflecting on the influence of teachers on me as a child, and I was able to think back about how growing up as a little Mexican-American girl in South Texas, you know, how small my world was for so long. And that things like having access to the library and reading, I was a voracious reader and I watched a ton of television. And, you know, those were sort of my outlets to other things. And it was really just the ability and the confidence to be able to follow my curiosity that allowed me to imagine things that really didn't seem possible, that were outside of Corpus Christi. And when I think so much of the American dream is really about or at least the way that I've come to understand it, is that sort of rags to riches story, that regardless of where you're starting from, regardless of your initial circumstances, you can get to wherever it is you want to go. And what's interesting to me is that as I've gotten to know more people, as I've been exposed to people that had extremely different circumstances than my initial ones, that it hasn't always been about intelligence or talent or drive, because if you started up here, you could be really mediocre and still make it. But you can be incredibly talented and incredibly smart, but depending on where your initial circumstances were, it might not matter. And so I think that is really the crux of the question when we're thinking about, is it dead? Is it alive? Is it possible? Did it ever exist? Right? Because it depends, right? It depends on who you're talking about and where they came from and how they started out. And so I think we're going to get there. But one of the ways in which that has changed over time and how it varies from place to place is something that I think is really important.
That dovetails both with some questions or some ideas I've been thinking about, but also with one of the questions from the audience. But this one was in reference saying they really appreciated, loved Dr. Doyle, what Dr. Doyle said about dreams here in Montana. And the question is there evidence regarding the connection between the achievement of the American dream in place, which is what you were touching on? You were referring to it as circumstance, but I think with Matt, with your research, you all have some ideas to talk about or some place to start, and then we can continue from there. So the question is related to how does the American dream relate to place of origin, et cetera.
I can talk a little bit about the evidence that Opportunity Insights, the organization I work for, put together related to this. So basically what they did in one of their studies was they took 20 million observations from tax data, and they mapped people back into the neighborhoods that they grew up in. So we're looking at kids who, you know, were born in the 1980s and 1990s. And then for those 20 million individuals, for each neighborhood in the U.S., we can summarize their outcomes in adulthood, summarize things like average income, broken out by where they grew up, the income of their parents, and their race. And so when you put all of those pieces together, what you see is that rates of economic mobility across the U.S. vary dramatically. And so, you know, this is true both at a broad region. So places like San Jose, Salt Lake City, and even Bozeman have very high rates of upward mobility. So what do I mean by that? The prospects of children who are born into low-income families, those kids are likely to kind of escape poverty in the next generation. The rates of upward mobility in some of these cities like Bozeman rival those to kind of some of the most mobile countries in the world. So places like Canada or the Nordic countries like Denmark, Finland, and Sweden. But in contrast, there's other parts of the country, like Charlotte, North Carolina is one example, where your prospects, if you're born into a low-income family, are dramatically worse. And so we're talking huge differences, like the consequences of being born into a low-income family in a place like San Jose versus Charlotte could mean almost earning twice as much in your early 30s. So these are big differences depending on kind of where you grow up. And kind of one of the really interesting findings that comes out from this data that I think we'll touch on later is that these types of differences across place persist at the hyper-local level. So if you go in and you zoom in to an individual city, and you look at the outcomes of kids who were born into low-income families, if you look at the outcomes of those kids across neighborhoods, you'll see a similar type of variation in their later-in-life prospects. So within any given city, there are some neighborhoods that seem to do a really good job of kind of catapulting kids out of poverty in the next generation, and other neighborhoods that could just be right down the street where kids who are born into low-income families seem to be stuck in poverty generation after generation. And so this data just suggests that place and neighborhood and community has a really dramatic impact on shaping people's prospects and shaping rates of at least economic mobility in the U.S.
Oh, it's a great question and a great answer. Thank you for that. You know, I'm kind of like a philosophical thinker and kind of tend to pick a different view on things. And I enjoy history and very much looking at history through an anthropological lens, but it's very difficult, I think, to separate the American dream from colonialism. And from that context, just about every place where you see a colony, there's a dream. The people who came there came with their dream, you know, to have this place that was, you know, gonna finally be the place for them. And then hand in hand in that was this idea of a democratic process that, you know, there would be, the people would have the freedom to make their own decisions and within the context of that, that they would support one another economically to have a viable means of way of life, I guess you could say. So in thinking of like small area communities, you know, that's a whole nother conversation, but I think for most of us in Montana growing up here in the 20th century, late 20th century, we just understood that, you know, if you're going to live in Montana, you're going to have to sacrifice a lot of things. And one of them is going to be a big salary. But you're going to have other things. You're going to be home. You're going to be able to stay home. And Montanans have been saying that for a long time. Gosh, it'd be nice if we could stay home. You know, if our kids could stay here. You know, I wonder if that's possible. And as a native person, this is my homeland. I honestly, if I had to move out of Montana or, you know, the Wyoming area or Upper Yellowstone, I would feel defeated. I would honestly, it would be the American nightmare for me. Because there's just too much history in the ground here for me to say, oh, I can't afford it, you know. It's cheaper over there. You know, I can come home for the holidays. Thinking about that Christmas song, you know, there's no place like home for the holidays. I think when I first left the reservation and I heard that song and I thought, that's like white people, that's the story of their life. They don't care where they're at. Like the world is just an object, you know, it's an object. one place is just the same as the other. Go get a job over there, Tommy, Johnny, you get a job over there, Susie, you take a job over there. We'll see you at Christmas. It's like, wow, that's the American dream. You know, not for me. I don't think for Montanans it is. We want to be able to be in proximity to one another. Sometimes a 3-hour drive is a good thing. But I can still get there by lunchtime. So I think place is, man, it is so much an important part of the American dream. And are we getting pushed away from the place where we want to be? Or do we have an opportunity to be in the place where we feel like we belong? That's the big question here in Bozeman, that's for sure.
I just want to chime in a bit because I think the question of place raises some other aspects of the American dream of this aspect of, is economic mobility the only part of the dream? And I wanted to tie it in, because I know your research touches on it a bit, Matt, and we've discussed it a little bit, but Ariana, you brought it up in your opening remarks. How do places tie to community, or communities are often tied to place? How do you see community also shaping the American dreams, or the dreams, as Shane is kind of suggesting, the dreams that Americans have as individuals as well, but how might community tie into that? And I'm, in terms of your research, thinking about relationships and economic mobility on one level, but.
I think community is a word that gets thrown around a lot, and sort of what constitutes community for different people really varies. And when I think about it, I think about support. I think about, in the pandemic recently, like having somebody that I could call if both my partner and I got sick, right? And I've lived in several places across the country and have really had to carve out and navigate spaces and community for myself that I had to kind of create from scratch. And so like what you're saying really resonates around, it's sort of like the notion of choice to me, of being able to determine for oneself how to get that community and whether a place feels like home or whether I can belong. Because in a lot of ways, growing up in Texas, I learned from a really young age that it wasn't a place for me. We weren't safe. My descending from a colonized people in my immediate family, we have a lot of different skin tones. And so my mother is very fair-skinned. My father is very dark-skinned. And I learned really at a young age that depending on which parent I was with, our experience was really different. Going around town, taking a drive, are we going to get pulled over by police? Is that going to be a safe interaction? What is that going to mean? And so as soon as I could, I left, and I have not been back. And I have zero interest in going back. In fact, when, in terms of attaining that economic prosperity, when my husband and I were figuring out, okay, where it is that we want to live, he's had some really great experiences in North Carolina, in Georgia, and he was like, you know, maybe these are some places we can move to. And I was like, ooh, I'm going to create the short list because there are some places that are just off the table for me because of racism, right? And like, I think that idea of place and of community and how one can make a place for themselves in spite of or as a result of, you know, different aspects of their identities is also really important because that dream isn't always possible in different places for different people, right? Like if I have to worry about holding hands with my partner walking down the street, that's not going to be a place for me, right? And regardless of any kind of economic prosperity that I might be able to attain, putting aside whether that's possible in a lot of places for a lot of people, that notion of safety is what I would come back to, and that wouldn't be my dream, right? Like that would be the nightmare. That would not be a choice that I would make. And so I think that's also a really important aspect of this conception to grapple with, because that is often not what we're talking about when we think of it in these sort of grandiose terms, right? It's usually the immigrant story. It's the colonial perspective of manifest destiny and sort of taking what's yours. And it's a lot more than that. So I'll leave it there.
So on this connection between kind of neighborhoods and communities, I think the central reason why neighborhoods are such an important predictor of economic success is precisely because of communities. And actually, some very recent research that Opportunity Insights put out brings some data to bear on this topic. It's a really interesting study. And what they did was they took data from Facebook. This is a data set that has a ton of information on the types of friendships that people are making. And using this massive data set on friendships, they created these measures at the neighborhood level of the types of friendships that people were forming. And it turns out that one of the main predictors of whether or not a neighborhood is going to be one of these neighborhoods that seems to be kind of a high mobility neighborhood where, you know, low-income kids who grew up in this neighborhood have a shot at success. The key predictor of that is whether or not kids in these neighborhoods are making friendships across class lines. So in neighborhoods where low-income kids are making friends with high-income kids, those are the exact same neighborhoods where low-income kids are escaping poverty when they grow up as adults. And so, you know, I think there's a couple of different things that could be explained in this. Maybe it's that low-income kids are being able to tap into the labor market and job networks of their high-income friends, so they're able to just get jobs. But I have to imagine that an important part of this is that having friends kind of across class lines and being exposed to broader ideas of what's possible kind of just shapes what you think is possible, your aspirations for what you want for yourself, but more kind of like what's in the set of possible options that you have for yourself. But certainly, like, the data supports that there's this, like, very strong connection between kind of neighborhood, communities, social structures, and long-run outcomes.
One of the other questions is dealing with the issue of affirmative action, and I'm not sure if anyone's open to addressing where you might see the role of affirmative action in supporting the possibilities for different kinds of successes, economic, educational, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that comes to mind around that question is whether there are some policy interventions that can be put into place that can make that dream more attainable for people who aren't starting, that their initial circumstances are not coming from like a high class sort of, it's expected that you're going to be successful even if you aren't exceptional in every way. You have the leeway to be able to kind of fail and mess up, however, because of your starting place. And affirmative action is certainly one of the policy interventions that we've tried. And because of the ways in which it's rolled out, because of the incredible pushback around affirmative action and the ways in which it was interpreted to go against the notion of meritocracy, which I think is intrinsically tied to this notion of the American dream, that regardless of where you start, if you're good enough, you'll make it. Well, that's not really the case for a lot of people, right? So if I think back to the ways in which the circumstances that surrounded me, I mean, I think I was just really lucky in a lot of different instances. I was able to avoid some really common pitfalls that people around me, people I was close to, people that were just as smart, just as driven, just as talented, weren't able to overcome. And I don't think that's because I was special or exceptional. I think it was that I was lucky. And that when I consider the structural pieces in place, like the town that I grew up in was always 15% above the national average for the time that I was in high school for teen pregnancy. We didn't have things like sex ed, not anything that was more than the really basic biology of it. We weren't given information to protect ourselves from unforeseen pregnancies, and therefore, the majority of my middle school friends ended up pregnant by the time, you know, it came time for graduation. What did that mean? Well, a lot of them dropped out. Some of them got their GEDs, some of them didn't, and most of them, I know from Facebook, are still in Corpus Christi. That very easily could have been me. Thankfully, it wasn't, right? And that would have prevented me from attaining the dream. Not to say that I'm sure many of them are very happy with their circumstances in some ways. And also, I know that they weren't able to pursue various aspects of their dreams because of something structural that didn't allow them access to information. So affirmative action is sort of an intervention that was tried, kind of. And the pushback that it received was around, well, now it's reverse discrimination because based on race, somebody's going to get a job over me, as though there is some sort of zero-sum, one-on-one perspective where the article that Jelani sent us, there was a Scientific American article that he circulated because we've been talking about this stuff for a while. And in that article, it said the author was saying, my friend was really disappointed because his son wasn't able to get into a college of his choosing. And he said that it's really hard for a middle-class white kid to get into college these days because of things like affirmative action. And then the author says, it got awkward when I said that the fact that he was a middle-class white kid actually helped him to be able to go to college at all. And then the circumstance, you know, the conversation didn't really go very far after that, right? And that's the conversation that we don't have. That instead of thinking, oh, I got passed up because of this one person of color when the whole company is overwhelmingly white, why is it that the target becomes the one person of color who got hired? Maybe it was that that one person has overcome a bunch of different obstacles that you don't even recognize. And so it's complicated. It's not something that we can just say yay or nay. And I think that affirmative action is one of those topics that doesn't get the nuance that it deserves. And it wasn't really given enough time to flourish. And so it was rolled back before we could really do anything about it. And the only place that it still exists is in college admissions. And I don't know that we have that for much longer. So long-winded way of saying people's identities do matter, and the experiences that they have in the places, even in high mobility places, I would bet, it's not exactly the same based on what you look like, based on how you're perceived. And there are certain intrinsic things to different people that walking down the street, you're going to be perceived and treated differently because of, that are just part of your humanity. And I think that that's one of those things that it's polarizing to talk about, but it shouldn't be because it's just a fact.
Just briefly to follow up in the very articulate description there of affirmative action and its purposes and why it's important. And within that context, thinking of the American dream is almost always explicitly an individual dream, right? I mean, it's always the dreamer going after his or her pie in the sky or whatever it is that they're trying to achieve using their talents and hard work as that person. And where does the community fit into all that? And, you know, the idea of affirmative action is to help a few individuals to fit into this larger puzzle of white-dominated academia, what have you, whatever it is. But what about those communities where those individuals come from? What about investing in those communities so that there isn't such a desperate need for folks in those areas to really break out of this entrenched poverty? And how long has that entrenched poverty been there? And what were the root causes of that? I think it's probably best that if we want to form public policy to have a more informed idea of all of those histories and mechanisms so that we can address them in a more comprehensive, thoughtful way, that we is actually going to achieve something rather than throwing a few dogs a bone and then having people like, that dog doesn't deserve a bone. He's got food in his dish right there. I mean, not to always metaphor, right? But, and especially dogs and Bozeman. Come on, people. I feel like we should think about the communities and not just the individual people within the American dream.
I think that individual piece is important when the communities are forgotten, because I think what often happens is there's a perspective of, well, I didn't have it easy, right? I grew up poor. I work hard. You know, what about me, right? And what I think is an important point to get across is that it's not to discount that there are a ton of individuals that have, based on their identities, some level of privilege along with them, right? Because that's also really important. Like, everybody has a struggle. Everybody has a story. And it's not as though that gets erased because you hear other stories from people that look different than you. I think there needs to be an empathy that happens with these sorts of topics to be able to relate to one another, that a lot of us have had it hard. And this is a policy that is claiming to get at the structural pieces while actually getting at the individual pieces. And so it's one of those sort of like using a hatchet instead of a scalpel things. And so I think your point around root causes is really important.
So going back to kind of one of the original pieces of the question of like, how does race fit into this? So if you look in the data, you can clearly see that there's a large kind of black-white earnings gap. So white workers on average earn much more than black workers. And kind of one question you could ask there is, there's a gap today, but will this thing kind of like dissipate and disappear over subsequent generations? Like, and maybe you would expect that if you thought that kind of we lived in a world where there wasn't discrimination or something like that. But in fact, like, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. So in particular, if you look at, for example, two kids who are born into low-income families, so families with very similar incomes, and look at their life trajectories, what you'll see is that the kid who is born into a white family, on average, will do better in terms of income than the kid who is born into a black family. So there seems to be some kind of additional disadvantage that cuts along racial lines in addition to income. And interestingly, that gap is completely driven by males. So white daughters and black daughters who are born to parents with similar income, they actually have kind of similar expected outcomes in adulthood. But this gap between whites and blacks is entirely driven by young boys. And so when you look at young boys who grow up in poor households, you see this large gap later in life for those individuals. And even more interestingly and somewhat depressingly or quite depressingly is this gap in earnings is also very apparent in incarceration rates. So just an absolutely insane statistic is that for black boys who are born into the kind of lowest income households in the U.S., 20% of them will be incarcerated on any given day, which is just an insanely high number. And so, yeah, I think like that piece just highlights that in terms of kind of how race relates to this, I think the criminal justice system is a huge part of that. But then more generally, I think there is kind of a race-specific piece to the intergenerational puzzle. And so policies like affirmative action, if we're going to think about achieving equality along racial dimensions, like policies that kind of cut across both class and race lines are going to be necessary to achieve equality there.
Yeah. How do you think social media has impacted senses of the American dream? And the question refers to people posting hashtag best life ever.
The American dream has always been tied to innovation here in America because America has always led the world in technological, cultural innovation. You know, we were talking about this earlier, steam engines, cotton gins, airplanes, radio, rock and roll. Of course, I'm a big rock and roll fan. And then now we're in this new era of technological innovation that's completely dependent upon the internet. And it's a dynamic I think we're still trying to figure out. One of the things that may or may not be connected to social media is the great resignation and expectations that the next generation has of the American dream. And why is everyone else having it? And I have to work at McDonald's, someone said 10 years ago in a meme, you know, well, your parents called flipping burgers an opportunity. And you guys don't want to do that today because you're too lazy and you're too spoiled and you're too entitled and right? But the fact of the matter is, like, you so eloquently stated at the very beginning of this conversation, flipping burgers in 1955 is a lot different from flipping burgers in 2022. And the circumstances have changed, and now it's becoming more apparent with social media that gap and that space that most people have to make up between being able to barely afford your cell phone and actually having a place of your own and some safety and security and fulfillment in your work is pretty big. And I think that there's some angst. There's a lot of angst. And there's a lot of people trying to figure out, where do we go from here? And I think that's part of the reason why we're having this discussion tonight and why the question even arises, you know, is the American dream dead? So
picking up briefly with something you said about flipping burgers, because in Bozeman, there's signs that you can flip burgers. This is a little sarcasm here, so I have to put my sarcasm parentheses up, for a decent wage. Some of the questions are relating to this issue of the aspect of if having a strong job market might help to indicate that there is still possibility, there's still something about the American dream. And if that way, even though the paths to success may be variable, but there's still possibility for working hard and potentially achieving some successes in that way. Again, thinking about it in an economic sense.
There are definitely pathways that exist today that people can pursue upward economic mobility. But I think a lot of those relative to 20, 30, 40 years ago, a lot of those pathways have closed down. And so just kind of like highlighting some of the big things that have had a change since the 80s. If you kind of look back, starting in the 1980s, we see this massive rise in income inequality. There's a couple of big drivers of that, which I think have played a role in shutting down these pathways of inequality. So what went on there? Two of the main factors were related to the supply and demand of skilled workers. So basically, starting in the 1980s, some combination of technological innovation, things like automation, and exposure to trade, so shipping jobs kind of overseas, led to this large increase in the demand for skilled workers. So instead of having a company consist of a bunch of people who were doing manual jobs that maybe didn't require a college degree, now you've outsourced or automated those jobs and replaced, you know, 50 jobs with one kind of software engineer or something like that. So this type of story over the last 40 years has played a big role in driving up the wage premium for a college degree. And during that same time, we've seen that the rate at which people are going to college just hasn't kept up in pace. And I think a big reason for that is during the same time, you've seen just a massive rise in the cost of college education. So for most families, like even though our best estimates of the return to a college degree justify that high price tag, so in a purely financial sense, like for the average student on the margin, it actually makes sense for them to pay the massive tuition price and go to college because their like future expected earnings gains will exceed the cost of college. For a lot of families, they're just like not in the position to take out that loan or make that risky bet in case like something takes them off track and they're not able to finish their degree and get those kind of earnings gains from paying tuition. And so we've gotten into this place where there's a lot of people then who aren't able to afford a college degree. And for them, the chances of upward economic mobility are much more limited. And so that comes from what I said of these forces that kind of reduce the number of jobs available for or in demand for low-skilled workers. But it also comes from the erosion of other things like the fact that we've barely raised the minimum wage since the 1980s and also a massive decline in kind of rates of unionization. So all of these kind of labor market institutions that we used to have that kind of supported and propped up earnings for people at the, you know, at the lower end of the income distribution, those things have disappeared too. So like you said before, flipping burgers is very different now than it was 30 years ago, in part because just the minimum wage, you can be paid much less for it today. And so I think those are kind of some of the factors which have shut down some of these channels that used to be available for people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and work their way to economic opportunity.
One of the questions or comments deals with multiculturalism. A couple actually do, and so different perspectives on the American dream outside of the U.S. But this one also shifts the idea toward thinking about aging as a process. So the American dream tends to be oriented around youth, and can youth achieve something different than maybe their parents? And this touches home here in Bozeman because there are people who have actually achieved the American dream, if you will, who have worked hard, started off in lower income or working class families, gotten an education, achieved a decent income, and then decided to move to Bozeman before the recent gold rush, as Shane framed it, built a home with their own hands and live in that home and then retired. But the rising costs of property taxes make it difficult to sustain their own dreams, right? So I'm just highlighting that as a context. So thinking about that component, I'm just highlighting that also from the question too. So how might age and how might the idea of sustaining one's success over time play into questions around the American dream being dead, or how do we create, as James Adams framed it, right, a little bit more than motor cars and wages, but something else about opportunity and for all. And we haven't really gotten to it, but this question of how do we contribute to each other's lives to support not just high incomes, but high quality of life as well. So thinking about barriers, what are some things that we might be able to do locally in our communities, perhaps to affect some of the current challenges to whatever we may perceive as the American dream right now? If you all have any suggestions. You know, might as well
small question.
Pick the brains of the experts, right? We have them.
Well, one thing that came to mind as you were talking, Jelani, is this, what we do or really don't do for folks who are aging in this country. We do not take care of our elderly in any substantive way. You are very much on your own. If you can retire, it's really up to you and your family to handle that. And with the cost of healthcare, with the cost of assisted living, I know it's something that I think about constantly, and I'm terrified of my mother having a fall or my husband, who's an only child, his parents having some sort of a medical emergency, and whether we can afford to take that on. And frankly, the answer is probably not. And so that's one thing that comes to mind. Another thing that comes to mind is how much of a luxury it is when we think about attaining the American dream. I have really only thought of it up to maybe age 50. I haven't really thought about it after that. And I mean, my American dream is to be able to retire someday. And most people in my extended family, I have a very large extended family. My mom's one of six, my dad's one of eight. My grandfather worked manual labor in Texas oil fields till he was 78. My mother is knocking on 70 and is still working so that she can pay her mortgage, right? And I think that there is, in terms of what can be done, how do you create policy intervention so that people can stay in their homes? Do you cap? I know that this exists in Texas. I know that it exists in California, though it's been implemented in not a great way. But essentially that the price that you bought your house at ends up being what your house is taxed at. And so that way you can stay in your home, even especially right now when housing costs have increased dramatically, astronomically, even in a lot of communities. It just doesn't seem fair that if you were able to pay off your home, that then you have to leave it, or that, you know, maybe you have to sell it, but then you have to leave your community and this place where you have your people, where you have some level of support, especially in an age where that support is even more necessary. And so that would be one thing that came to mind for me.
So I can respond to one thing in that question, which was this idea that of rising home prices, which I think is on the top of anyone's mind in the U.S. I think this is like a major issue in our country, both for this issue of pricing people out of their neighborhoods, but also kind of restricting access to some of the best high opportunity neighborhoods in the U.S. So as I mentioned before, the neighborhood in which you grow up in has a massive impact on your life trajectory. And the current state of our housing policy really limits access for most families to a lot of some of our country's best neighborhoods. And so I think the kind of obvious issue that's driving up home prices everywhere are issues related to zoning. And so if we were just able to kind of change policies, a lot of these are instituted at the local level, to allow higher density housing, things like apartment buildings, that would go a long way towards addressing this housing crisis, which is really being felt across the country right now. Probably Bozeman, given that it's such a desirable place, has really felt it since the telework boom post-COVID. But this is a problem that's, I think, every city in the U.S. is facing right now.
I don't think I could really add too much more other than just to say there's probably should be a national discussion about these topics that should be ongoing, just like so many other topics that we should be talking about that we just kind of ignore. They're not woven into our national conversation. I'm not sure how you do that, but you know, I think there's ways to do it. I think that America has always been a youth culture, and the youth culture is linked to consumption, massive consumption. And all those things go against elderly wisdom. And somehow we haven't been able to balance in our society the sexy appeal of youth culture and, you know, how much money they spend and, you know, all the things they do and how they drive the economy in so many ways. And then just like the elderly wisdom that we look to for the next generations to guide us to what's valuable, what's important. And kids have never been good at listening to their elders, like James Baldwin said, but they've never failed to act just like them. It's what they see, it's what we do that will ultimately cause the next generation to try and ultimately follow in our footsteps. And so nothing ever changes until we start to think and talk about it. And so that we have to start there.
Not everyone will attain this ideal of an American dream. And one of them wants us to think about a little more of what impact that might have, right? If we are promoting this anyone can achieve mythos, and then those who don't quite achieve, whatever that may look like, what kind of impact that might have on individuals, on families, on communities, and whether or not a lateral metric or some other, we start to get to what might be other ways to conceive or create new kinds of dreams as well. So maybe dealing with the impact aspect, if you have some suggestions there, of what might be the impact on people not achieving that dream.
So I can respond to that in a more literal sense of just like, if we have an economic system that gives all the rewards to a small group of people, what that means in effect is that just there's not that many people who are going to be able to have a decent income. And that's kind of exactly what we've seen, you know, happen over the last 40 years in this country. It's insane if you look at who has benefited from economic growth since the 1980s. One way to explain it is if you go back to 1980 and you ask, you know, how much more were the top 1% of people earning than the bottom 50% of the population? That number is about 30 times. So the top 1%, on average, their annual income was something like $500. And people in the bottom half of the population, their income was something around, you know, $15,000. So $15,000 a year. So bottom half of the population, our top 1% of the population is earning 30 times more than the bottom half. Fast forward to today, that number has grown to 100 times. So the top 1% is now earning $1.7 million a year, and the bottom 50% is still earning around the same amount they were in 1980. So the average income of the bottom 50% is about $18,000 now. And so just what that means is that since the 80s, basically all of the economic growth that our country experienced went to this tiny portion of the population that's at the very high end of the income distribution. And so taking your question a little more literally, but what that means is that when you have a system like that, you just can't have broad-based opportunity because all of the resources are going to one group. So I think looking forward, if we are really serious about having a country that's going to create opportunity for everyone, we need to be serious about creating a system that's going to share the economic growth and progress with everyone instead of having it accrue to some tiny fraction of the population.
Incredible answer. I completely agree with that. One thing when I think about the impact that can have on a community, I think that it could lead to nihilism, it could lead to hopelessness, but also throughout our history, it has also led to organizing and has led to people coming together and agitating and fighting for change. We saw that in the origins of the labor movement where working conditions were horrible, where children were working, where there weren't any days off, where it was incredibly unsafe to go to work. And therefore, it was incredibly unsafe to earn a livelihood because there really isn't a choice there. And so, you know, you had people who really put themselves on the line from wildcat strikes to organizing into labor unions to say, no, we're going to do something different. We have to do something different and force that change. You saw it in the civil rights movement where people who were completely subjugated, you know, went through this tremendous paradigm shift and imagined, envisioned a different world for themselves, put themselves on the line in many cases in harm's way, were horribly violated and in some cases even killed, and made tremendous strides to fundamentally change our society and the ways in which we treat Black and brown people. And so when I think about negative effects that something like that has on our society, I do have hope that people are coming together and we're seeing it, right? We made a lot of comments about flipping burgers, but years ago when the Fight for 15 started, that seemed insurmountable. That seemed completely unheard of. And how often have you been driving around and seeing ads, work at Wendy's for $16 an hour? It doesn't make any sense to me that the jobs that are often the most difficult, the most physically taxing, and the least attractive in a lot of senses end up getting paid the worst. And so I'm hopeful that people are joining up together and really fighting for changes that are going to benefit that 50% that hasn't seen those gains for so long.
So now I think we are at the closing thoughts moment, and if you all have any closing thoughts, then I would love to hear it, and I think the audience might like to hear it. Anything else you want to add to what's already been said, please feel free to do so. And I do want to thank the Library Foundation and all the people who support the Bozeman Public Library for helping to have events like this. Shane mentioned the idea that we have more conversations around these topics so that we can hopefully be energized to, one, think about them in an in-depth way. Oh, I'm going to be on stage and I have to think about what the American dream is like, or I might write a question in the audience, but also get new ideas to consider how we can keep dreaming, right? How we can keep making a better future for everyone around us in our communities and elsewhere, not just in the U.S., obviously, but hopefully, this is my closing thought, but we're at a point where our dreams have to be much, much bigger, right? We're dealing with planetary dreams at this point.
Thanks, everybody, and I'll just make a final comment by saying that maybe we don't have the answers and maybe we don't have the will or we don't have it in our grasp right now to make some of the changes that are necessary to really turn the ship around, but maybe if we prepared the next generation, we prepared them through information, through education, that they might be able to see further and do better than us. And not to give up on us, but just to say that there's more to come and that it would behoove us to invest our energies and our abilities in these young people so that they can, again, achieve this, what really, to me, is a generational American dream, that each generation, as we said earlier, will find a way to do better than the previous, and not just economically, but all around. So thank you.
Yeah, I want to thank you for having me. First of all, this has been such an engaging discussion. I think my closing thought would be that we do more of this, that we really try to meet each other where we're at and really seek to be curious and empathetic with one another. The organization that I work for, the Equity Project, the central tenet of our organization is that we create and maintain spaces filled with grace. And that means that we aren't shying away from difficult conversations, but rather we are fully present in them and we're leaning into them and encouraging people to listen and not just wait to talk. And we aren't doing enough of that in our society today, and I think our polarized climate is a testament to that. And so my dream that's come out of this conversation is that we have more spaces like this and that we challenge ourselves. I'll challenge everyone in the audience to talk to someone and really listen to where it is that they're coming from. I'm sure that some of the things that we said tonight aren't things that you're totally on board with. And I just want to thank you for giving us the space to be able to share our perspectives. And thank you all for staying and for coming and to engage with us in this way. And I hope that you'll continue to do more of that. So thanks so much.
Just echoing everyone's thanks. So I'll just leave you with a couple of thoughts I have about how you all might continue to engage with these issues based on kind of the research we've done at Opportunity Insights. Basically, two broad themes. So one, coming back to this point that economic opportunity varies drastically across neighborhoods. So if you go to our website at opportunityinsights.org, there's a link there to something called the Opportunity Atlas, which is an online tool that allows you to visualize how kind of rates of economic mobility vary across neighborhoods. So if you click on that link, it'll bring up something that looks like Google Maps. All neighborhoods will be shaded different colors based on kind of the rates of upward mobility in those neighborhoods. And if you zoom in to Bozeman in particular, you'll see that even though kind of, like I said before, Bozeman on average is a pretty upward mobile city in the U.S., that there is some variation within town. So, you know, I know very little about Bozeman, but from looking at the map, I could see that kind of on the north side on Main Street, those neighborhoods up there tended to be somewhat less mobile, upward mobile. So low-income kids who are growing up in those areas have worse prospects. Whereas just south of Main Street, things seem to be a little bit better, at least based on this map. And those differences seem to be quite big. So kids who grow up just on the south side of Main Street could be expected to earn about 50% more than the kids who grow up on the north side of Main Street. So point number one, hopefully I didn't offend anyone who lives on the north side. Again, this is not me or my impression, just based on the data. Okay. But I think that the key point from that is that the solutions to upward mobility, a lot of them are local. So you don't need to wait for federal or national policy. But if you can kind of understand and take the successes of the like high mobility neighborhoods in your area and translate those and replicate them in other neighborhoods, there's a lot of scope for moving the needle on upward mobility. And then the second piece comes back to this social capital issue. So again, if you go to the Opportunity Insights website, there's another link to this thing called the Social Capital Atlas, which looks very similar to the Opportunity Atlas, but instead of showing how rates of upward economic opportunity vary across neighborhoods, it shows how measures of this social connectedness variable constructed from the Facebook data varies across neighborhoods. So again, it's this measure of, you know, how often are people creating friendships across class lines. And so if you look at Bozeman, perhaps not surprising because Bozeman is a high upward mobility place, it's also a place where people tend to make friendships across class lines. And one of the key findings that came out of this Facebook project was that kind of local organizations and local institutions play a really big role in kind of shaping the way that people make connections. And so, you know, I think one kind of concrete way that you could think of engaging with these issues is to kind of support and engage with local institutions like the public library that's, you know, in the business of trying to build community and bring kind of everyone from the community together in one space and forming relationships. And so, yeah, I think that's just like one way in practice that you all could actually have a really big impact in terms of driving rates of upward mobility, because I do think a lot of the solutions to our national problems are really at the local level. So yeah, if you go on our website at opportunityinsights.org, you can kind of check out some of this data and see that I wasn't just being biased toward the north end of Main Street. But yeah, thank you again. Thank you again for your time.
I think that's the end of our program for this evening. Thank you all for joining us.
You have just heard a symposium forum on the question, is the American dream dead? MSU Bozeman's Dr. Jelani Mahiri, who moderated a panel discussion featuring Dr. Shane Doyle, Ariana Flores, and Dr. Matthew Steger to explore that question. We regret that technical difficulties at the beginning of the event held at the Ellen Theater on September 28, 2022, prevented our broadcasting the introductory remarks. Thanks to the staff at the Ellen for recording this symposium, in particular, Porter Webb and Mike Wykes. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.